Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News, has a bold, blunt assessment of the American healthcare system. She writes, quote, "It is rigged against you. We hate our healthcare system, and yet we've come to accept it as an inevitable burden of being American." Well, the 22-year veteran of the New York Times says the big business of healthcare has taken advantage of us all. She details how doctors, hospitals, drug companies, and insurance providers have evolved to the point where they exploit American sickness. Her new book is called An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. And I should say, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
This is quite a book. And I want to get to sort of your assessment of modern American healthcare in a second. But I mentioned the doctor part because you were a practicing physician, what, 20, 25 years ago?
I come to this as kind of a labor of love. You know, I was a doctor. My dad was a doctor. So I've kind of watched this system evolve in ways that make me deeply uncomfortable.
How different was it a quarter century ago when you were practicing on a day-to-day basis?
Well, a quarter century ago, you could see some of these elements, the business elements, coming into healthcare. But I think it's really escalated, as we've seen all in the last maybe 10, 15 years, to new heights, to unsupportable heights. I mean, when I was training, there was still a head nurse who was, you know, really devoted to what was right for the patients. And you could see kind of managers coming in and the start of this movement for greater efficiency in healthcare. And the truth is, healthcare, if you want kind of the patient-doctor relationships that we all say we value, it's not an inherently efficient operation. It shouldn't be run like a machine. But yet what's happened is this caring endeavor, which focused on what was best for the patient, what science showed, is now kind of underpinned by this commercial enterprise whose values are those of business. It's efficiency, revenue generation, all of these things that sometimes are compatible with good patient care, but often aren't.
So you have a quote in the book from William Sage, professor of health law at the University of Texas. And you quote him as saying, "Medicine is a business. It won't police itself. People had a lot of faith in the American medical profession that they would act differently than other businesses, but they were wrong." Why is it that we were all wrong?
Well, because I think that's a really complicated question. So much has changed. What you see is kind of a step-by-step evolution where doctors start thinking of themselves, you know, first there's insurance, which I always have to say is a good thing. Basically, people need health insurance, but there's a separation of what people are paying from who's paying it, right? Mm-hmm. So there was this sense, oh, well, kind of nobody's paying this now. So it felt kind of like a white-collar crime, and in the sense of hospitals that maybe were charging $50 for something would say, oh, now kind of the insurer's paying it, so no one's really paying it. So let's see what happens if we charge $200 or $500. And then the consultants come in and say, you know, suckers, you could be charging $2,000 for this. Why are you only charging $100? So, you know, it's been a slow evolution that we really need to start reeling it back, because 20% of our GDP and families paying 20-30% of their household income for health care is just, it's not sustainable.
Yeah. So I wonder if you could give us an example of how market-based approach to, or business-based approach to healthcare, what impacts that it has? Because in the book, you write about, for example, like you talk about how there's a story that you tell about how we in the modern day may not end up with, if the polio vaccine were being developed now, we wouldn't get a polio vaccine. We'd get something else entirely.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when I was practicing medicine, and certainly when my dad was practicing, there was this notion that thinking about the finances was kind of a not what you should be doing. And, you know, one thing that really kind of amused and horrified me as I was preparing the book was seeing that a lot of the pledges that the American Academy of Surgery uses or the American College of Surgeons uses have taken out the without regard to a patient's ability to pay part. So suddenly that became acceptable to think about. What are the finances? How much money's being made? And so what happens is, think about something like diabetes, right? If you had a cure for diabetes, you would destroy a multi-billion dollar industry of medicines, pumps. You know, you look on TV, you see ads for Januvia all the time, you know. So in terms of you're looking at this as a business proposition, you don't want an immediate cure. You want people to be treated for life. So now if I'm a person with diabetes, I want to be cured.
Yeah.
You know, that's the optimal. And all of these treatments are good. They're valuable. They're wonderful. But there's no incentive to develop the ultimate treatment, which is to make the disease go away.
So this is a provocative thing to say in, you know, you're speaking to an audience that's living in one of the
medical
hubs
mecca
of biotechnology and pharmaceutical research. And I'm sure there's thousands of people out there who would say, no, Dr. Rosenthal, I've committed my life to finding cures.
Right. And that's true. There are many wonderful people in the field. But how do we get innovation now? We like to say, you know, we depend on pharmaceutical companies to innovate. Well, pharmaceutical companies are for-profit companies. So they're going to innovate things that they can sell. They're not going to innovate things that don't yield money. So that's why, you know, some of the doctors who are working away and the scientists who are working away in labs maybe don't have the same interests as the pharmaceutical manufacturers. It's important, therefore, to keep public funding for research going because there's a certain kind of research that industry is magnificent at producing. And there's another kind which, you know, they'll be very open about. You know, why would we invest in this? You know, there's no product that might come out of it.
Well, in the book, again, the book is An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. You present... We're talking about how healthcare as a market isn't working in America, and you present what you call the economic rules of the dysfunctional medical market. And there are 10 rules here. I won't read them all, just a couple of them. One, more treatment is always better. Default to the most expensive option. Two, a lifetime of treatment is preferable to a cure. And then there's a couple of other interesting ones. For example, number four, as technologies age, prices can rise rather than fall. And five, there is no free choice. Patients are stuck and they're stuck buying American. And six, more competitors vying for business doesn't mean better prices. It can drive prices up, not down. Now, why is that in healthcare?
Well, it's because initially, well, and you see this here in Boston, too. Initially, the whole... the trend to consolidate hospitals, you know, for hospitals to join together, made a lot of sense the way it does in any industry. You know, you join together, you have efficiencies of scale and purchasing. Not every hospital has to buy its own laundry sheets. Not every hospital has to do heart surgery. But what you see over time is consolidation reaches a tipping point so that in many markets, there's only one or two hospital systems left. And at that point, they do what any big organization does when it can control price. They're kind of a monopoly. And they say, you know, this is what we're going to charge. And guess what? If you're a patient, you're not very well positioned to say, wow, if I'm in San Francisco, I see it's cheaper in LA, I'm going to go there. And also, if you're a patient, and it's why this is not like any other market, your doctor says, here's the best place for you to go. It's not like you're shopping around really for healthcare. And that's why I say you're kind of captive. Now, you can, and I think people should say to their physicians, for example, if I need a blood test, please send me to a lab that's in network so I don't incur out-of-network charges. Or if you tell me I need my elbow x-rayed, you should know, physicians, which x-ray facility does that at the cheapest price. Because as we've seen in multiple papers now, one facility and another three blocks apart can be 100% different in price. So your doctor knows which ones are good and should send you to the cheaper one. And P.S., my challenge to physicians is to say, you're not going to send patients to the one that charges $1,000. You can say to them, sorry, you know, my business isn't going to you anymore.
Yeah. So tell me more about the role that individual doctors play here. Because, I mean, we talked about sort of the biotech, pharmaceutical industry. You touched on hospitals and the effect that all that consolidation is happening. But at the individual physician level, is there, you know, what role are they playing in this giant puzzle of ours?
Well, I think you'll see in the book a lot of the sources, my best sources are physicians who are just as frustrated as the patients on the whole, I'd say, because they deal with this crazy system and the coding and the reimbursement issues 24/7. I go nuts when I deal with it for an afternoon on one bill. So I think for starters, you know, they often also have no idea how much things cost. They can't find out, you know, okay, I'm keeping my patient in the recovery room for an hour. What are you billing for that, hospital? Because maybe I won't keep the patient there for an hour if it's a crazy charge. They don't know. They have very little control over what different facilities charge for an X-ray or for an MRI. But and it's partly because in medical school, and I went to medical school, you don't learn these things. And I hear from medical students, tell us, teach us, you know, teach us how we can think about price. Because it's really depressing to physicians, and you hear this a lot. You know, you take out someone's appendix and you think you've saved their life. And then 2 weeks later, they're in your office saying, hey, doc, I just got a bill for $25,000 and I can't afford it. You know, that's for doctors who care, and most care a lot. That's just devastating.
Yeah. So, Elizabeth Rosenthal, it seems as if your fundamental critique is that healthcare, the successful delivery of effective healthcare, it may be one of those things that doesn't positively respond to what's been a basic American belief for a long time that the free market is best.
Yes, and I don't think we don't have if to have a free market, you need prices, price transparency.
You need transparency.
So people can make choices. You need the ability to actually choose where you go. You need information. So if a doctor is saying, ah, your knee hurts, you need surgery tomorrow. You know, maybe you're like me, you're kind of a wonk and you have medical knowledge, so you know that most knee surgery, almost no knee surgery needs to be done tomorrow. You're a little bit, you're incredibly vulnerable. And P.S., as you're making all these choices, you're sick, right? So it's not a good market. And I mean, if we like, look what a market looks like. I mean, say you want to buy a Prius, right? You can go to five different Prius dealers and find out what it's going to cost. And it won't cost 100 times as much to buy a Prius in New Mexico as it does in New Jersey. So this is not a functional market. And I don't know that a functional market will ever solve this, because healthcare isn't a choice in many cases, right? For a functional market, I need to be able to go into the grocery store and say, blueberries are really expensive, I'm not going to buy them right now.
Okay, so then is single payer not the solution then?
Well, it's a solution. I think what you see, you know, I'm a journalist, so I can't say, I have my preferences, but I don't think I can say there is one solution. I think what we see as you look around the world, and I was overseas as a foreign correspondent for a number of years, so I experienced a lot of different health systems, is that every country will pick a health system that suits its national cultural preferences, its politics, how doctors practice. Some of those are national socialized health systems like Canada and Great Britain. Others are single payer systems, like our own Medicare system is, where the government pays and there's some price regulation. Others are a little more free market, but with some mechanism to control price and cost, because healthcare nowhere is just a free market. So I think we will have to find our solution in terms of how to face head on this price and cost issue, because until you do that, you know, we can look to the ACA or some of the new GOP plans, and we're not going to solve that Rubik's Cube of healthcare. You know, the ACA did a lot of really important things. It protected people with pre-existing conditions. It removed lifetime caps for what your insurer could pay. It kind of changed the dialogue in saying that government should be responsible for trying to get everyone health care or at least health insurance.
Yeah. Can I just jump in here? Because we've got under a minute to go. Yeah. Just briefly, do you think single payer wouldn't work in America, not because of like practical reasons, but more cultural reasons? Is that what you're saying?
It does work other places, of course. Our decision is it in line with our cultural values? And everyone says, you know, oh, no, we couldn't do a single payer here. You know, I would say it doesn't line up perfectly, but our current health system is such a mess and people are so frustrated that, in fact, a lot of physicians now are in favor of single payer, right? Yeah. So that's the crucial switch that usually flips when a country moves in that direction.
Well, we only scratched the surface of all the compelling stories and analysis you have in this book. It's truly a must read. The book is An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became a Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. It's by Elizabeth Rosenthal. She's editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.